I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. In San Francisco today, the streets are filling and security is very tight as bearers of the Olympic torch prepare to make their way through the city streets. This is the only U.S. appearance of the torch ahead of the August Games in Beijing. Human rights protesters have already disrupted torch-bearing ceremonies in London and in Paris, where they managed to extinguish the flame and force the cancellation of the final leg of the ceremonial relay. In San Francisco on Monday, protesters scaled the Golden Gate Bridge to hang banners in support of a free Tibet. Joining us now is Scott Schaefer, who's covering the story for public radio station KQED. Scott's also the host of the California Report. And Scott, tell us where you are and give us a sense of what you're seeing on the streets.
Well, I'm standing right next to the San Francisco Giants baseball stadium, looking out across Willie McCovey Cove, named for a former San Francisco Giants baseball player. And I can see off across the water where the ceremony, place where the ceremony will take place to light the torch. I see several dozens, maybe even 100 Chinese flags, red Chinese flags. There are maybe 1,000, 2,000 people gathered already. This is the beginning of that six-leg stretch where the torch will be relayed throughout the waterfront area of the city later today.
And give us a sense of how city officials are preparing for this event. As we mentioned, there have been protests in other cities. How's the city preparing for this?
Well, they've been watching very carefully. Of course, they've been planning for months and months and months. They've known that this day was coming, and they've been watching carefully the events in London and in France. The mayor yesterday had a meeting, actually, with the French ambassador to the U.S., who that was a long-scheduled meeting, but he happened to be in San Francisco. And so they've been trying to adapt the plans here to based on what's happened already in Europe. The route has been shortened. Originally, the route the torch was going to take was going to include the Golden Gate Bridge. It was going to be a ride on a cable car. It was going to go through Chinatown. All those things have been scrapped. It's now a pretty stripped-down 6-mile relay route. And the mayor said yesterday that that route may well change even after the torch relay begins. So they have contingency plans to change the route, to shorten it, even to change the way in which the torch is passed along as it makes its way along the route. So they're being a little tight-lipped, as you might imagine. They don't want to reveal too much, but it does seem as though they have a backup plan upon backup plan.
I see. And I understand there's quite a range of protesters. We mentioned those Free Tibet supporters who scaled the Golden Gate Bridge. There are people supporting the Darfur refugees. I've even read of a group of nudists who are protesting, calling for a return to the way the ancient Greek games were played. Any sign of them, Scott?
I'll keep my eyes open. This is a complex, diverse city, and especially when it comes to things political. There was a very large rally last night with Richard Gere and South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu in support of Free Tibet. Very critical of the Chinese government, Richard Gere, longtime friend and supporter of the Dalai Lama. But there are also protesters, a large contingent protesting Chinese support for Sudan and the Darfur situation. There are people protesting the illegal harvesting of organs. And then let's not forget, there's also a very large Chinese and Asian American community here in the Bay Area, and they're very proud that the games are happening in Beijing this year. There's a lot of ethnic pride. They may not support what the government is doing in Tibet and elsewhere, but they feel a lot of pride that their country, their homeland, has come onto the world stage. They may not be pleased with the publicity from the past few days, but there is a lot of pride as well.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you. What do Chinese folk in San Francisco, what do they feel about these protests? And, is this dividing the city? Briefly.
Well, of course, briefly, because it's a very diverse community, and it's hard to say what they are feeling because there's a lot of different feelings. I know there was anger from the Chinese business community here when last week the Board of Supervisors passed a resolution saying that they wanted, urging the city to accept the torch with alarm and protest. That really rubbed the Chinese business community the wrong way, and the mayor did not sign that proclamation. So, like I said, there is, I think, disappointment that there's so much controversy, and there will be, I'm sure, a wide range of views and expressions of feeling today.
Scott, thank you so much. That's Scott Schaefer covering the story for us. He's from KQED. He's also host of the California Report. Thanks, Scott.
You're welcome.
Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said today that young people need to be smarter about the way they handle their money if the nation's economy is going to improve. A new survey shows that on average, high school seniors answer correctly just half the questions about personal finance. Bernanke said people need to be more financially savvy so they don't get tangled up in risky credit deals like the millions who took out subprime mortgages they couldn't afford. Because of the financial crisis, credit is now harder to come by, and that's leading many people to turn to payday lenders. Depending upon your point of view, these are either much-needed lenders of last resort or extortionist loan sharks exploiting the current economic downturn. Whatever they are, they're proliferating. Payday lenders are supposed to offer short-term loans, but too often they're saddling distressed consumers with long-term debt. That's because they carry stratospheric interest rates, on average about 400%. Consider the case of Gail Myers from Columbus, Ohio, who joins us now. And Gail, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us how much you borrowed from one of these payday lenders and what happened.
Well, I was going through a divorce, and at that time my daughter and I had moved into our own apartment. And to make a long story short, I started getting behind on my bills. I had already maxed out all my credit cards. I wasn't receiving any kind of child support from my soon-to-be ex-husband. I was working a full-time job as well as a part-time job every other weekend. However, living on a limited income, I started getting behind on my bills and went to a payday lender because I couldn't go to any banks at that time because, in fact, my debt-to-income ratio was now too high for my income for me to qualify for a loan.
I see. And so how much did you borrow from the payday lender?
I borrowed $300 and had to pay back $345 2 weeks later.
And did that work out? I mean, is that what you did?
Well, it worked out for 1 week or 2 weeks, and then I had to go back the following day to borrow another $300 because of the fact that when you already don't have that money in your budget, and then when you do get paid, you have to pay back that payday lender, so you're back where you started again, short again. So now not only was I $300 short in my budget, I was $345 short in my budget.
And so how was this resolved eventually? Did you manage to get it paid off?
Well, 2 years and about $2,500 later, I finally was able to, you know, use some of my income tax monies as well as some of my own monies that I had saved up to be able to replace money not only in my own budget, but also to pay back that payday lender so I wouldn't find myself in that, you know, same situation again.
So after 2 years, you had to pay back over $2,500 to this payday lender.
2 years and $2,500 off an original $300 loan, correct.
Now, we've read that some borrowers get harassed by these payday lenders if they're slow in paying them back. What was your experience?
Well, you know, I was scared to death. You know, I didn't want them calling me or my friends. I did pay back the loan on time. However, you know, when I was paying, going in to pay on my loan, I would hear them call other people's family members, friends, you know, threatening to turn them into the banks, you know, trying to find out where they're at to get a hold of these individuals. And here I am, just somebody coming in trying to pay off my loan and have to overhear everybody else's situation.
So, Gail, what advice do you have for other people facing similar situations?
You know, I would strongly encourage individuals to talk to their friends and family, you know, try to find other alternatives other than a payday lender. I think people need to realize payday lenders are nothing more than legalized loan sharks. And unfortunately, at this point in time, there is no regulations on them, and there needs to be legislation passed to regulate payday lenders.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk a little bit about those regulations and what states have them and what states don't. But Gail, let me just ask one sort of pushback question to you, and that is, you weren't surprised by this, were you? I mean, did you understand what you were getting into?
You know, in all honesty, I didn't. I mean, I initially thought that I was going to pay, you know, borrow $300. 2 weeks later, I get another paycheck. I'd be able to pay it off and be able to go on. However, that wasn't the case because, like I said before, you don't, at the time when you have the unexpected financial crisis, you're doing whatever you can to survive.
Right.
You become desperate, and people do desperate things in desperate situations. And I figured, like I said, I would be able to pay that money back, be able to go on. But, you know, I didn't figure, okay, I paid back that $345. Now I'm $345. I don't have to pay for, you know, the next bill coming my way. You know, so unfortunately, I found myself in this vicious cycle of debt and seeing no way out.
Well, Gail, thanks very much for talking to us today, and good luck to you.
Great. Thank you.
That's Gail Myers of Columbus, Ohio. And for a broader perspective on this issue, we're joined now by Uriah King with the Center for Responsible Lending, a consumer advocacy group in Durham, North Carolina. Uriah, welcome.
Thank you.
You heard Gail's story. How typical is a story like that?
Unfortunately, that is far too common. In fact, the average payday borrower pays $800 to pay back a $300 loan.
$800 to pay back a $300 loan. That's quite a bit.
That is the average experience of the typical payday borrower who walks into that store for the first time. Hmm. And perhaps even more troubling is not only is that the average experience for a borrower who walks into the payday loan store, that is what the business model is dependent upon. The vast majority of revenues that are brought to the payday lending business model come from these heavy, heavy repeat borrowers, the serial repeat borrowers that really struggle to pay back the loan. About two-thirds of all their revenue comes from borrowers taking out 12 or more loans a year. And, you know, 12 payday loans over the course of a year is hardly a short-term loan.
Now, from the reading I've done, I understand there's a high level of default on these loans, up to 50%. So I'm curious how the payday lenders make money on this.
Well, yeah, that's right. A very recent study by a law professor at Vanderbilt, an economist from Oxford, noted that within the first year of taking out a payday loan, over half of borrowers end up defaulting on their payday loans. And the reality is that the reason the business model continues to work is that, you know, the other half doesn't default and they continue taking out loan after loan after loan, each time generating new fees for floating the same principal. And the reality is when you charge that high of an interest rate, you only need to take out, if you take out four or five loans, the lender's already well into the black at that. When you're charging 400% interest rates, it doesn't take a whole lot to make this business model work.
Well, the state of Ohio, where Gail lives, seems to be a hot spot for the proliferation of these payday lenders. We spoke to the Coalition of Homelessness and Housing in Ohio, and they said about 1,600 payday lenders are set up in Ohio. Why are there so many there?
The real reason is that Ohio has really had a lax regulatory structure for some time. They've been legalized there. They can make up to an $800 payday loan, which is unusual, and it's very profitable from the industry. Obviously, for somebody that's paycheck to paycheck that has minimal savings, even at a lower interest rate, an $800 loan is very, very difficult to pay back, if not impossible, just in a few days, and plus pay off your other bills. And when you couple that with a 400% interest rate, as is legal in Ohio, it becomes nearly impossible. And what we know is that the way the industry says this loan product should be used, that is going in, taking out the loan to pay for the emergency, and then walking away and not taking out another payday loan, only happens about 1 out of 100 times.
Wow.
Only 1% of the time does that actually happen.
We're talking to Uriah King of the Center for Responsible Lending about the proliferation of payday lenders, companies that offer short-term loans with a very high interest rate. When we come back, our conversation continues. We'll also hear from a payday lender in Ohio who says her company is filling a vital need. And later in the show, an Iraq war critic asks, if the surge is working, why not sustain it and send even more troops to Iraq? Stay with us. It's Here and Now. We're talking today about payday lenders. These are normally storefront businesses that make small loans of a few hundred dollars with interest rates that can go as high as 800%. According to consumer advocates, payday lenders made $28 billion in loans in 2005, and they believe that figure is climbing thanks to the current credit crunch. Our guest is Uriah King of the Center for Responsible Lending in Durham, North Carolina. And before we get back to Uriah, we called several payday lenders for an interview. Most of them hung up on us. We did manage to speak to a manager at America's Payday Loans in London, Ohio, outside of Columbus. Her name was Amber. She declined to give her last name. Here's what she said about how these loans work.
We require you to have full-time employment, and you're not allowed to borrow any more than what you make. So it's not like we entrap people, you know. Our services are basically to help people out. Say you don't get paid till next week, you was in a car accident, and you need $300 to get your car fixed. They're not meant to be a permanent solution to you being in debt.
And when we asked Amber about those cases in which people ended up paying $800 back on a $300 loan, here's what she said.
That's if you would borrow every 2 weeks for a whole entire year. You know, I'm sure I may have the people that come in because they blew their money at the bar or wherever, you know, but most of my people, you know, as adults, they know exactly what they're getting into. It's explained to them. They sign the contract. It should be their choice. Basically, we're here, we're helping out the guys that maybe your credit's not so great. You know, maybe at one time or another, you flubbed your credit. If you go to a bank, you're not going to be able to get a loan. If you need that money today, that's what we're here for.
So that's Amber, a manager at America's Payday Loans in London, Ohio. What's your response to that, Uriah? What do you think of what she says?
Well, there's a number of issues raised there. I think the first one is to point out is that, you know, that's just the average borrower, the $800 for 300. It would, if a borrower were to take those loans out every 2 weeks for the entire year, it would be much more than that. It would be about $1,600 of fee income for the original $300, which we do see happen. We recently did a study. We looked at 13 million loans made over the last year or so and found that to be the average. That's the typical experience. That's not anecdotal evidence. That's not saying, well, that's not what most of my folks do. The other thing is the industry's own data says that borrowers do have other places to turn. I don't necessarily disagree with that. Over 60% have a credit card. Only less than 10% have no other place to go besides the payday loan store, at least for that first time when they first walk into the store.
But doesn't she have a point, Uriah, that people know what they're getting into? Doesn't the consumer have to accept some responsibility here?
Absolutely. In general, what we support is a level but fair playing field for all small lenders. And what most states have done and what Congress recently did for all military families was pass a 36% rate cap on all small loans. No special deals, no special exemptions, just a 36% level playing field for all lenders. And what we've learned is that from other states is that preserves a vibrant small loan market while weeding out the debt trap of payday lending. North Carolina, for example, when we passed a 36% rate cap for all lenders here, we saw small loans of $600 or less go up by over 40%. And, of course, those loans are at most 36%. And this is at the same time weeding out hundreds of millions of dollars of fees that would have been lost to the payday loan debt trap.
So, Uriah, I understand 13 states have that 36% annual percentage rate cap, but the other, 37 states don't have that kind of regulation.
That's right. What's happened recently is that, especially since Congress passed what's called the Talent-Nelson Amendment, which put a 36% rate cap on payday loans to military members, we've seen a number of states basically saying, well, if it's good enough for military families, why isn't it good enough for Oregonians or for all Arkansans? Why is that rate good enough for all families in our state? And so state policymakers have been moving aggressively to level the playing field and level it fairly on behalf of the families in their states. Mm. While that's a relatively small number, the thing to point out is that represents, because those are large states like New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, North Carolina, and Georgia, that's one out of every four people live in a state with a rate cap of 36% or less. I think, you know, really this foreclosure crisis and the credit crunch that's really caused by the meltdown in the subprime mortgage market has really given both federal and state policymakers pause about the informal policy that virtually everyone was pursuing. And that policy was that access to credit is a good thing no matter the cost, no matter the terms. And I think the foreclosure crisis has made it painfully clear that, yes, indeed, there are prices too high to pay for this informal policy of access to credit at any price.
Well, we've been sort of talking about the effects on individuals of these payday lenders. What's the larger impact on the overall economy?
I think there's two points I would want to raise to that. I mean, remember, for somebody who's trapped in this debt, paying these fees over and over again, they're not really getting new value. It's not like they're getting a new $300 to put on the street, so to speak. This $800 in fees that they're paying, this would otherwise have gone to legitimate, responsible businesses. This money is being extracted from families who need it the most. This money would have gone towards housing like rent, utilities, pharmaceuticals, food, school supplies, really the basics. So I think legitimate businesses really feel undermined by this debt trap that people get into.
Okay, understood. And the second point?
And I think the second point would be that the recent study that I had referred to that compared borrowers who were either approved for a loan or were denied a loan. Remarkably, and this is a remarkable finding, but they were using real borrower data and real loan data, and they found that borrowers who were denied a payday loan were 90% less likely to file a bankruptcy. So that means that borrowers, one of the worst things could happen to you is being approved for a payday loan because you're 90% more likely to file for bankruptcy. But that means you're defaulting. That means you're forced to default on other debts. And, of course, you know, those costs ultimately get borne by the society as a whole. Those are bills that aren't going to get paid elsewhere.
Well, Uriah King, thanks so much for talking to us about this today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. That's Uriah King. He's a policy associate for the Center for Responsible Lending, talking to us about payday lenders. General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker are back on Capitol Hill today testifying about the war in Iraq. General Petraeus is calling for a suspension of planned U.S. troop withdrawals this summer, reflecting concern about the recent flare-ups of violence in Basra and Baghdad. He also calls the recent security gains fragile and reversible, and his position now is pretty much stay the course. Critics of the war are also testifying today, and one of them is our next guest. Andrew Basevich is a retired Army lieutenant colonel who served in Vietnam. He's now professor of international relations at Boston University, and we should also mention his son Andrew was killed while serving in Iraq last year. Professor Basevich delivered his testimony to the Senate Armed Services Committee, and Andrew Basevich, welcome back to Here and Now.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
In your testimony, you ask the question, if the surge is working, as some claim, then why not sustain it? What's the answer to that?
Well, let me give some context to the question. I mean, it's really one of the fundamental principles of war that when you achieve success, you reinforce success. And therefore, the question for those who claim that the surge is successful, then why are we taking away the 30,000 troops that we sent there last year? Why not send another 30,000? Why not send 60,000? And, of course, the answer to that question is those troops don't exist.
In other words, if the answer is more troops and arguably there's been some security gains as a result of more troops, then why not send more and more and more troops?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the real point here, I think, is that there is an unacknowledged gap between our military commitments, not only in Iraq, but also in Afghanistan, on the one hand, and our military capabilities on the other hand. And specifically here, when we say military capabilities, we're not talking about how many F-16s or aircraft carriers do we have, but the number of soldiers in the Army and in the Marine Corps who are bearing the brunt of these wars, which have already gone on more than 5 years, and which seem unlikely to end anytime soon.
Well, as we mentioned, General Petraeus has called the security gains fragile and reversible. Do you agree with that, or at least with the idea that there has been some security gain made?
No question about it. Yeah. I mean, there's no question about the fact that there's been a substantial decrease in violence in Baghdad and in Iraq more generally. Having said that, there's even forgetting the uptick in violence that we've had over the past week or so. Over the last 6 months, we've averaged about 500 attacks per week against U.S. forces and Iraqi security forces, and that's simply an unacceptable level of violence. So yes, there's been some progress. There has not been enough progress on the security front to bring about this so-called political reconciliation, which was supposed to be the purpose of the surge in the first place.
Mm. In your testimony, you spoke of those recent security improvements as highly contingent. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think most observers agree that that we've achieved the gains in security less because of the addition of U.S. forces than because of a willingness to cut deals with Shia militias, Sunni insurgents, warlords, basically paying people, arming people, making concessions to people to put down their guns for the moment. But to imagine that those concessions have won these adversaries over to our side strikes me as an illusion. Mm. And indeed, I think we're seeing the extent to which the gains are fragile in the recent violence with al-Sadr's Mahdi army.
Mm. And what are the long-term consequences of those concessions with these various factions that are hostile with one another? What are the long-term consequences to the U.S. effort there?
Well, your you're putting your finger on, I think, which that the key issue, and the key issue is the long term. I mean, for anybody to imagine that political reconciliation is going to happen next month or the month after that, they're kidding themselves. For those who believe that, that this war must be continued, that we must persevere to the end, they need to face up to the facts that we're going to be fighting in Iraq for 5 years, perhaps even 10 years, that even when the fighting begins to dwindle, there's going to be a requirement to maintain a substantial U.S. military presence there. In other words, this is an enterprise that is going to continue for decades. Mm-hmm. I think it's foolish for us to continue the war. But if indeed this administration or the next administration wants to continue the war, then it seems to me that there is an urgent imperative to increase the size of the forces that are being committed. I mean, we have a situation now where we have soldiers going back to Iraq for their third or fourth combat tour, where for all practical purposes the rest of the country has tuned out the war, is uninvolved, and could care less. Mm. I think that that's bad for the Army. And I think it's morally indefensible.
In your testimony, you said that the Iraq War has revealed the limits of American power, that the Bush Doctrine hasn't worked. It's a stalemate. We're stuck. So what should be done? I mean, you talked about if we're going to continue this war, then we've got to, you know, seriously up the ante. But I take it you're not in favor of that. What should be done?
Not at all. I think that's the basic choice. I think the basic choice is either we up the ante, meaning we commit the country to the war, or we find a way to liquidate the war, to pull out. And there, I think my view very much conforms with the view of the much maligned Iraq Study Group back at that rendered its report at the end of 2006, and that is we need to begin withdrawing U.S. combat forces. We need to recognize that the Iraqis themselves are going to have to solve their problems. We can't come up with a solution for them, and that we need to begin to attending to the negative fallout that is going to come from this misguided war, which is ending in failure. And that's primarily a diplomatic effort, not necessarily a military effort.
What do you say to people like John McCain, the Republican presumptive presidential nominee, who was speaking just this week about the need to stay the course and pretty much criticizing calls for a withdrawal of U.S. troops as creating a vacuum that would allow Iranian influence into the region in a much bigger way and create an even bigger danger for the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I respectfully disagree. And if that's what Senator McCain believes, and if that's what Senator McCain does, or that's the conviction that's going to guide him when he becomes president, then I would simply say you're going to need to mobilize the country. You need to double the size of the army, because the Iraq War, if we insist on fighting it indefinitely, is going to be with us indefinitely. And the force as it exists today cannot sustain, five more years of combat operations.
Well, Andrew Bacevich, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. That's Andrew Bacevich. He's a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel who served in Vietnam and now a professor of international relations at Boston University. And later this week on Here and Now, TV legend Phil Donahue on his new documentary about a wounded Iraq war veteran. That's this Friday on Here and Now. During World War II, the battle for the Tarawa Atoll was the first major U.S. offensive strike against the Japanese in the Pacific. This official Marine Corps film documents the U.S. invasion against heavily fortified Japanese defenses on November 20, 1943. When the brutal fighting ended 3 days later with an American victory, more than 6,000 American and Japanese soldiers and Marines were dead. Leon Cooper, now 88 years old, was a Navy landing craft officer during that battle 65 years ago. He's written a book about his experience called The War in the Pacific, and today he's fighting for recognition of the Tarawa battleground known as Red Beach. Leon Cooper, welcome.
Thank you, Anthony.
Now, the fighting for these Pacific Islands, and this one in particular, was particularly brutal. Give us a sense of what that battle was like and what you could see from your landing craft.
I saw scores of guys within a few yards of me being cut to pieces by Japanese gunfire. And I made a number of trips. Each time the carnage was as bad as the one before. My unpleasant job after the battle was secured was to bring the dead and wounded back to my ship for medical treatment and other things.
Now, Mr. Cooper, you visited Red Beach recently. Give us a sense of what it looks like today. What did you find?
It's an outrage. Garbage everywhere, all over Red Beach. It's such a disgrace and an insult to the memory of all the guys who fought and died there. I went there so I could get an action program going with the help of the officials of the government of Kiribati, as it's called, which includes Tarawa, and they're enthusiastic about my ideas. So hopefully, with funding from the U.S. government, urgently needed over the years for cleaning up the garbage and doing other things. Mm.
So you would like the U.S. government to get involved in cleaning this up. You'd also like some kind of memorial there, is that correct?
Red Beach should be a permanent memorial to those guys who fell in that battle. All over that tiny island, there are the bones of American and dead Japanese.
Mm.
I was walking along the beach, Red Beach, to relieve the painful memories of those awful 3 days, and I bent down on what I thought was a piece of coral. It's a shard of a bone from, obviously, an American, because the major killing of Americans took place on Red Beach.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese were killed inland a bit.
Well, Mr. Cooper, it's a troubling story that you tell. Is anybody listening? Are you getting the kind of response that you'd like to get from any part of the U.S. government or from the Marine Corps?
I tried for almost 3 years to get the usual suspects in Washington, the White House, members of Congress, the Pentagon, Secretary of Defense, to pay some attention to my urgent pleas that something be done about the garbage on Red Beach. And I was ignored. I got nothing except a few routine letters of acknowledgement, and so I decided to go myself. And I brought a camera group with me to film this carnage and this disgusting spectacle on Red Beach and elsewhere, filming meetings that I had with officials of the government in Kiribati. And so your listeners can look for information about the documentary that will be available in a matter of the next couple of months.
Mr. Cooper, let me ask you, how many of you are still with us today who participated in that campaign on this island? Do you have any idea?
Not many. I'm hanging on. There are not many guys left. Every now and then I hear about a few survivors. But those who survived still look upon those 3 days of savagery as being the worst experience in their lives, and that certainly is the case for me.
Mm. Well, Mr. Cooper, I want to thank you for talking to us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for your call, Anthony.
Leon Cooper is a World War II veteran. He's working to clean up and memorialize the Tarawa battlefield in the Pacific. His book is The War in the Pacific, a retrospective. For more information, visit our website, here-now.org. Coming up, is too much screen time robbing today's kids of their childhood? One expert says yes and offers some advice on how to help kids thrive here and now. Nancy Carlson Page says childhood is being stolen from our children. That's right, stolen. She says an array of modern forces, from overbooked schedules to a media-saturated world with endless depictions of violence, is robbing today's children of the most precious moments of their lives. Dr. Carlson Page is a professor of early childhood education and conflict resolution at Lesley University in Cambridge, Mass., and she's author of the new book, Taking Back Childhood, Helping Your Kids Thrive in a Fast-Paced, Media-Saturated, Violence-Filled World. And she joins us here in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. You write that children today are losing nothing less than their childhood, that childhood is being stolen from them. How?
Well, I think that some of the basic bedrocks of healthy child development are eroding out from under children, under the weight, really, of an accumulation of societal forces, the media, certainly, the numbers of hours that children are spending consuming media, between 3 and 4.5 hours a day, screen media, depending on children's ages, combined with the kind of content that they're seeing, which is far too much violent and sexualized content that can be scary and confusing for children. There's enormous escalation in commercialization of childhood, with $15 billion a year spent now on marketing to kids, which is a huge jump from just a decade ago.
Let me focus on this number of hours that kids spend in front of the video screen. You say this is robbing them of direct experiences with the real world and what you describe as creative play. Why is creative play so important?
It is one of the richest and most important resources in children's lives. It's a way that they work through experiences, make sense of what happens in their everyday lives, resolve things that are traumatic and upsetting, and also develop creativity as they bring their own personal stories into their play and work them through. And it's also a rich development ground for problem solving and intellectual development.
And yet there are fewer and fewer opportunities for this kind of creative play.
Both in terms of time and in quality. That is to say, children are playing less for sure, but also the quality of children's play has diminished as the marketing to children of media and toys, products, you know, merchandise, videos, video games, all organized around a single theme, say Star Wars, Transformers, whatever the theme, Spider-Man, has had the effect of taking away from children their own stories.
A lot of what you write about, especially in terms of all of the time that kids are spending in front of video screens, it seems sort of intuitively obvious that this isn't a good thing, but I was also struck by how science has a lot to say about the way children's brains develop and that creative play actually plays a key role in brain development.
Neuroscience has been telling us a lot in the last decade. Their brain circuitry is developing as a result of their direct experiences, and that's why, in terms of play, children need to actually interact with hands-on experiences in a first-hand way, three-dimensional experiences, and looking at a screen, neuroscience can show us, is not going to develop the brain as fully or well as these interactive first-hand experiences, and that's true also for social and emotional learning.
So what are the solutions? I mean, for the typical, overworked, tired parent to keep their kids away from television and computers and video games, it's almost impractical.
Parents can very easily, actually, reach for what we call open-ended materials or materials that aren't so defined. Most of the things you'll see on toy store shelves are very defined toys that have some kind of purpose. You hit a button and the toy, you know, might throw a knife or throw a dart or an arm moves or a leg moves. But the best kinds of toys and materials for children, and this is really critical, are ones that encourage them to bring their own meanings to the material. Hmm. So things like blocks or Play-Doh or paper and markers.
They should be interactive or sort of promote a kind of response rather than just hitting a button and watching.
Yes.
There's an anecdote in your book that I think a lot of parents might identify with. You describe taking your own grandson on a trip, and just as you're leaving, he starts crying because he doesn't want to leave his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And you describe that instead of putting a video on to distract him, maybe even comfort him, you show him a picture of his mother. What's the message there?
I was talking about Miles, who was 5 years old and leaving home for the first time for the weekend with us. And as the experience pressed down on him and we were ready to leave, he began to cry, "I'm going to miss Mommy." It would have been easy for me to get my laptop out and say, "Do you want to watch Finding Nemo or something?" as a way of distracting him from the feelings he was having. But actually what I want to do is help Miles work through the feelings of separation and get to the other side so he knows, I can do this, I can get through this. So we got a picture that he looked at. He looked at it several times and he asked me to hold it for him, asked it for it back several times. But this way he got to have the experience of separation and put that into his emotional repertoire, if you will.
Let me ask you about something else that you write very passionately about, and that is how all of this media reflect the real violence that's going on in the world. And you open your book talking about a disturbing case involving a close friend of your son's, a boy named Jesse, who was mugged one night in Cambridge, Massachusetts, robbed of his leather jacket, stabbed to death. And you write that Jesse's murder gave your work more urgent and personal meaning. I wonder if you could just talk about that.
Yes. Well, I had been working in conflict resolution for many years before Jesse's murder. And when someone I loved very much was murdered by young people, it seemed more urgent because of the escalation of violence in the whole society. It seems more important to me than ever that we start to think about what are the foundations, what are the roots of violence. And in fact, I believe, and that's a lot of the reason I wrote this book, that they occur in our everyday lives with children, and we can do a lot to lay the foundation for giving children more tools and a different sense about human relations. That is, that they don't have to be based on win-lose kinds of relationships, but rather they can be more mutual.
How can families protect their children from the effects of that kind of violence that we hear about all the time? I mean, what are some practical steps that can be taken?
Well, on the practical side of protecting children, I want to say we need more protections at the policy level.
We're talking about protections in the media.
In media.
Right.
And that we do need to see greater protections, and a number of professional organizations and medical organizations have called for these. So the weight of this shouldn't be on parents alone, and it is right now, and that's unfortunate. The American Academy of Pediatrics does recommend no television before the age of 2 because of concerns over brain development that are very real. And then also to start to examine ourselves as parents and adults in children's lives. How can we step back and use our power with kids, our adult power, in ways that shift our relationship into more of one of working with and working together, rather than showing them a different kind of relationship? Well, let's say two kids are having a fight over a puppet. A parent can step in and say, stop fighting. You're always fighting. Go to your rooms. Sit over there and sit over there. Go to timeout, which are common approaches, and they're appealing for parents. But there would be a way to step in and try to get the kids to problem solve the situation. And it doesn't take any more time over time, because the children's familiarity with this approach, when we use it consistently, grows, and they begin to be able to do these things on their own. But a parent might say, there's one puppet and you both want it. What are we going to do? So the parent is more neutral in this case and helps the kids actually get on the same side of looking at a problem together.
That's Nancy Carlson Page. She's a professor of early childhood education and conflict resolution at Lesley University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Her new book is Taking Back Childhood: Helping Your Kids Thrive in a Fast-Paced, Media-Saturated, Violence-Filled World.